Hello and welcome to Physics Frontiers, episode number 53, Electromagnetic Gravitational Repulsion. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/53. Show notes include the articles you read for this program, books we may have mentioned, and links to related episodes of Physics Frontiers. And now, Jim and Randy.
Hey, Randy, what's going on?
Hey, Jim, it's good to hear from you. Today we're going to talk about a number of really fascinating topics involving gravitation and electric charge. A friend of mine online brought some work by a theoretical physicist named David Waite to my attention shortly ago, and he's got some videos on YouTube and he's got his own website. Apparently, this guy is doing his own exact solutions to the equations of general relativity, and one of the things that he found was that an electric field creates a gravitational repulsion with a 1 over r cubed force law. Although I know you really shouldn't talk about forces, but rather accelerations in general relativity. So I started looking through the literature to try to find anything about this, and he didn't have any papers published that I could find about the subject. So I was kind of skeptical about it at first, but the more I looked at it, the more credible it appears to be, and I'm kind of stunned. And then it also leads into some really fascinating subjects involving the interior of black holes. And the Penrose diagrams that are fascinating but complicated, where, you know, you've got two event horizons with a charged black hole or a spinning black hole. You know, there are pathways between those two event horizons that can move you into different adjacent regions of space-time. And apparently, in some situations, you can even chart a course between these two event horizons and end up in a different time. Like end up in an earlier period of time. It's really fascinating stuff. I'd love to do an entire show just on the Penrose diagrams and the interior architecture of different kinds of black holes, because that's absolutely fascinating. But what we were looking for this show was some insight into this electrical field relationship to general relativity, and to see if there was any validation for what he was talking about. And you did find exactly the right paper by Lowe that was published in the Journal of Physical Science and Application, called Comments on Unification of Gravity in Electromagnetism by Mohammed A. L. Lakhani and Einstein's Unification. And he actually makes the exact same statements that I'd seen from David Waite's work, where, you know, he talks about the gravitational repulsion of an electric field. And apparently it's so small under normal charge density conditions that you wouldn't observe it, but it becomes extremely significant at really steep electric field gradients and at very short distances. And that just kind of blew my mind. And then there seems to be some indications of this in papers going back to the 60s, where they talk about gravitational repulsion in electric fields, mostly in the context of like theoretical constructs where you've got like a charged spherical shell that's collapsing. And what happens to it in different reference frames, like from the exterior and from the interior reference frames. And there was a paper that you found called Gravitational Bounce by De La Cruz and Israel from 1967, which touches on that subject and shows you how the Penrose diagrams work so that this collapsing shell of charged matter falls beyond the event horizon with respect to an external observer, but then it reaches a non-zero radius inside the event horizon, and then when it re-expands, it expands into a different space-time. Yeah. So, you know, we're used to thinking about black holes in the most simple sense, where you've got like a Schwarzschild black hole, where, you know, you've got a static mass that collapses down to a point without any rotation or charge. But that's not really a realistic model of black holes, because black holes are going to spin. You know, any astronomical body of matter, like a star or whatever, it's got an intrinsic spin. And as it collapses, it's going to increase that rate of spin. So you've got like the Kerr metric, which also has two event horizons in this fascinating space-time topology, which is represented in the Penrose diagrams, that shows you pathways through these different regions of space-time that sometimes that's the geometries can be similar to this, or identical, I guess, in practice to the space-time that we know and love. But in other regions, you've got things like time moving backwards. It's different signs on space-time coordinates. So all this was really fascinating, and I think it's going to lead to a lot of great research and discussions. But I was really, really thrilled to find that odd but fascinating paper by Lowe, where he explicitly states a number of these things. And in his mind, it points to a unification scheme of general relativity where you've got a five-dimensional space-time, which I think had originally been worked on by Kaluza, maybe Klein, back in the day. But it had been abandoned, and maybe it had been abandoned because there is this novel mass charge interaction that is very hard to find much discussion about in those terms, you know? So I don't know where that's going to lead, but it does seem like a legitimate solution. And that kind of blows my mind because I was always given the impression, you know, that in the early days before we had the discovery of dark energy, that gravitational repulsion was some pipe dream. It was some unphysical theoretical construct and only fools believed in it and that kind of thing. But here we've got ideas emerging from general relativity itself, which reinforce the idea that these are physical solutions, you know.
How did you want to start this? Did you want to start with just the Riesner-Nordström metric because that started first, or did you want to look at something else?
Yeah, let's take a look at that because that's really fascinating. And that goes back to kind of the bedrock of how this all began to emerge is when people were looking at really extreme conditions. You know, that's a great testing ground for ideas in general relativity is you want to see the most extreme embodiment of the solutions so you can see what the real physical meat is for effects that would be difficult to model or calculate otherwise. So yeah, let's talk a bit about that. If the Riesner-Nordström metric we're talking about, and when you apply that to black holes, you're talking about charged black holes, right?
Yeah, so this is to do with charged black holes. And I think we've seen this before. I think there was something about this when we were talking about Robert Forward's work. So Robert Forward talked about all the different kinds of black holes, and he was talking about the charged black holes, and it had this metric in it. But apparently we didn't think because there's an additional term, you know, that adds on something that's proportional to the square of the charge, then that's going to be a repulsive term for your gravitational force.
Did he touch on that? Did he recognize that? It's been a long time since I read his work.
I don't recall him saying anything about that. So, I mean, he was talking about some of the different things that happen in these different kinds of black holes, but I don't remember him saying that there was sort of negative gravitational force. Of course, you'd say that the force for gravity is proportional to m over r squared. So it's an inverse square force. Well, the force from the charge on the black hole would be proportional to the square of the charge. So it would be repulsive whether it was a positively or a negatively charged black hole. And then it has a 1 over r cubed dependence instead of 1 over r squared, which means that the effect of the charge would only be something that you'd see close in to the black hole and farther away from it.
Gravity dominates again.
Yeah, gravity would be so much stronger that you wouldn't notice this small r cubed correction.
And this is really fascinating to me because here you're seeing a field, a single field, the gravitational field, which at short distances is repulsive in this scenario where you've got a high charge. And at larger distances, larger radius, you've got a gravitational attraction. And there's going to be a balance point between the two. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating to me. And it also reminds me, strangely, of the strong force, because with the strong force, you've got that same dynamic, right, where quarks have an extremely – well, actually, it's kind of – they have an asymptotic freedom where you know, get them further apart and their attraction actually increases. But at very short distances, they repel. So you've got that polarity of the one force doing both things at different scales.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what happens here, though. I mean, it sounds a little strange, right? Because when you end up having this metric, one of the things that they were saying is you have the normal thing that happens at the first event horizon. So at the event horizon, which is sort of a removable singularity, the singularity is at the event horizon is only there because of the way you parameterize space, right? So you pass through that event horizon, that radial direction becomes time-like, and time becomes space-like, which means that you're actually, time is flowing towards the center of the black hole, which is a strange thing to think about. And so you're really pulled towards the center of the black hole, but it doesn't feel like that. And everybody I know who's come back from being in the center of a black hole has told me that. But then you hit the second horizon, and then it switches back, or at least the radial direction becomes space-like again.
Within the second event horizon, you mean, it goes back to ordinary conditions where...
Or something similar enough to it, where towards the center of the black hole is no longer the direction of time. It's a spatial direction. Now, supposedly, on the inside, it's also asymptotically flat, and I don't know what that means. That could happen because something in the parameterization or something like that. But that sounds to me like once you get inside that second horizon, you're going to parameterize things a little bit strangely. And that could even be sort of projective, right? So that the point in the center, that singularity in the center, that non-removable singularity of your black hole ends up being something like the point at infinity. That would make it really interesting. I don't know if that's true, but that would be what would make it really interesting, because then all of a sudden, inside the center of your charged black hole, you would have basically a complete infinite universe.
Yeah, this David Waite was talking about you could navigate through a black hole and come out in different positions in time and space, depending on which regions you pass through. And there's like, you know, you could basically, if on the right trajectory, you could literally just fall through the black hole and like cross one event horizon and into a new space-time and then come out another event horizon. He seemed to be able to navigate these Penrose diagrams like most people navigate a map to the grocery store. So I'd love to take a closer look at that, because that's some really fascinating stuff. And I really want to see how that ring singularity, what the significance of that is in a rotating black hole. Because I don't know what happens if you pass inside that ring, or if you can even reach the ring. Because if you you've got a subjectively infinite space inside there, then you know, how could you even reach it, right?
That was kind of weird. I did read a second paper by Carter, which is the complete analytic extension of the symmetry axis of Kerr's solution of Einstein's equation. And I read that because one of the papers we read, a really short one, was the complete analytic extension of the Reisner-Nordström metric in the special case E squared equals M squared, where the charge is equal to the mass. And so when I went through that, it had some very interesting things. It sounded like if you went around that ring twice, you'd end up back in the space where you started, but I'm not sure where you go if you just go around it once.
Did he talk about the temporal implications of that? Because apparently, you know, time can do, you know, weird backwards things and so forth inside a black hole in certain regions, you know.
Yeah, I didn't see anything in there where he was talking about the time doing anything extraordinarily strange. I mean, it's hard enough looking at some of these things, because sometimes there are a lot of equations and you really want to know what's actually going on. But it seems like that was the only thing that was really weird that he wanted to point out. Oh, I should have read the questions of uniqueness and causality. I should have read that. I did read it, but I probably read it pretty fast because I don't have any notes on it.
And this one that you just mentioned, complete analytical extension of the Reisner-Nordström metric in the special case E squared equals M squared. He, at the end, it gets really interesting because he touches on how when you look at theory of particles in this context, apparently you can interpret the space-time as consisting of a complete manifold of infinite chains of universes that are connected by wormholes. I hadn't encountered that idea before. So apparently each particle could be regarded as being connected to an infinite set of distinct universes, or there might be some scheme where some of the universes are identified with each other. You know, some might be more proximal, I guess, than others. So, yeah, there was some pretty heady stuff going on with this type of work back in the 60s.
Well, they were really starting to look at the topology of space-time at that time. That's where you end up with the Penrose diagrams and stuff like that. Because now what you're doing is you're sort of looking at the different patches of space that you can put together, where you can take this patch of space and put a coordinate system on it, but that coordinate system doesn't work moving into the next patch of space. So you construct another coordinate system for that, and then you have to match up those coordinate systems. And that's something that they had to do in some strange ways a couple of times in these papers, because, you know, when you have those removable singularities, you can't match things at a singularity, right? You know, it's diverging. It's got infinities. You can't match infinities. That's not allowed. Maybe it is allowed, but I don't know how anybody does it. So instead, they match things a little bit on the outside of the singularity, of the removable singularity, of the outside of the event horizon, and let things go that way.
So that you can do transformations. So basically, if you were on a trajectory through a black hole of this type with like a couple of event horizons, you'd have to use different equations to figure out what was going on, depending on which region of space-time you were in. Man, that makes navigating the Starship Enterprise seem like a snap by comparison.
So if you ever see The Nature of Space and Time by Hawking and Penrose, that was a series of debates between Hawking and Penrose, and it was published like that. And that actually has a nice, clear explanation of the Penrose diagrams, if you want a clear explanation.
Yeah, we got to do a show on that, because this stuff is really cool. I was really just kind of touching on it to try to look at more fundamental question about electrical fields and the gravitational fields. And I think it would be really neat to compare the different Penrose diagrams from different types of black holes.
We might have to do a different sort of thing for that. We might have to do something like on YouTube. It would be very difficult to do it in this format.
Yeah, it's true. You really need to look at the map because they're freaking complicated.
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking at a diagram, let's say, it's helpful to look at the diagram.
Well, there's a little incentive for us to get our YouTube act together because everybody's like the second biggest search engine in the world besides Google now. So maybe some people can find us that way too.
Occasionally they do. But I haven't put anything up there for a long time.
Yeah, we haven't needed a visual content, so it seems kind of redundant, you know.
Sometimes in some episodes we talk a little bit more about the diagrams, and that sort of makes me want to go through and do that. But it also requires me to make basically a slide deck for the entire episode.
Yeah, right? 40 minutes of visual information. Yeah, that's a lot.
I gave up on that, but it's still a lot. Even if I say 15 minutes doesn't need anything more than a picture of your pretty face.
Why, thank you.
There's still a lot of work that goes into putting them together. And if you have a busy semester or something like that, it's really difficult to find time to do that.
Yeah, and now you've got to readapt all of your teaching schedule into a format where you can do it all online. Welcome to 2020, June.
It was going to happen anyway. You just sped it up.
Oh, that's a good point. Now you're ahead of the game. So let's see. What else do we want to look at here? There's the interpretations of the Reissner Nordstrom metric. That was looking at electric charges and gravitational fields and Einstein's equivalent principles. That was Grundler.
Okay. Well, did you want to talk about that? Because I thought that was a little bit off topic.
Well, it is a little bit, but it does touch on it. It does touch on this because it says, or maybe I got that wrong. Oh, that was the low paper that I'm looking at, actually. I think I put the wrong title on it.
Okay, the comments on unification. That one gets into it in detail, and he's really, really critical. It's very, very strange. If you listen to this guy talk, he is, you know, this nice, you know, modest, calm person. And then in this paper, it sounds like, this guy is wrong. He should have known this. What's wrong with this guy? You know?
Tooft was an idiot. Yeah, I know. I got some of that stuff. I was like, wow, you don't usually see that kind of snarkiness from theoretical physicists.
Yeah, but it's a little bit strange hearing him speak compared to reading this paper.
He's a real mild-mannered guy in person. So yeah, he just nailed it. I mean, he just says it outright. He didn't really show the derivations. Like David Waite goes through and shows you how he derived this exact solution for the electric field in general relativity. This guy just kind of states it.
Well, let's see. You mean for like the Reissner-Nordstrom metric? Well, I mean, he gives a reference for that. I mean, the David Waite thing, didn't he just sort of basically try to write his own textbook online? Because that's what it sort of felt like.
Yeah, that's right. But he goes through his derivations. Like, he's got videos where he'll take you step by step on how it's all done. And he shows you the matrices and transformations and the raising and lower indices and all this stuff. He's converting covariant tensors to contravariant tensors and showing you the problems that you've got when you've got to go through it. Yeah, he goes through it in detail. But then he's also got a website, I think, where he's got, you know, like an entire database of his own writings on general relativity. As far as I can tell, the guy is a freaking expert at this stuff. I mean, he seems to be so proficient with it that it's really daunting. Like, I would love to get to the point where, you know, I understood the equations well enough to transform them like he does. You know, I'm really jealous, actually.
Okay, so we look at this, and the easiest way to interpret this metric is to say that your electric charge gives you an effective mass of minus q squared over 2r.
Over 2r? Do you mean r cubed?
Well, what you do is you say I've got 2m over r, right? That's what you get for your mass term in the metric. And then, so your metric is acting in your time coordinate. It's 1 minus 2m over r plus q squared over r squared. And there's a name for that term, and I forgot that name for that term. It's another thing I was going to look up, but I took a nap instead.
You got to do it sometimes.
And there's a similar term for the dr squared term. But when you look at that, you can say, okay, well, what would happen if I said this q squared over r squared term is just dealing with the mass, right? It's acting like a mass. So this is sort of a negative mass. What would that mass be? It would be q squared over 2r because of the 2m in the original metric. Right.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So you're saying that you have this effective mass for your black hole of m minus q squared over 2r. And so that effective mass decreases the farther away you get from your object. And that seems like a reasonable thing. It's a little bit strange, I think, but it makes a little bit of sense. Right. If you're saying it's got something to do with the energy, then the energy from the charge drops off as 1 over R. But it doesn't really work quite that way. But you say, okay, well, it has to do with the energy, it has to do with the mass, and we're going to go along with that. Lowe doesn't like that at all. Right. So he says, okay, that's not very good because it doesn't give you the right force. It gives you a completely different force from what you'd actually expect. And so you'd get an invalid energy, and you'd see something that was the wrong mass. So you try to do it two ways, and you get different values for the energy in that situation.
And that was the objection that he had with Tehuft, right?
Well, Tehuft, I think, gave a cutoff. So, yeah, he gave a cutoff. So outside of a particular radius, that was what the energy was, right? And that makes a little bit of sense, but in that case, you'd get rid of all of the repulsiveness of the gravitation outside of there because of that cutoff. And Lowe says that what happens is that by doing that cutoff the way Tehuft does it, the electrical energy is counted twice. And he says he knows that because of an experiment somebody did that they didn't publish, but they presented at a conference in 2007.
Yeah, Sipniak and Andreev. I don't know who these guys are, but apparently when they charged a metal ball, the weight of it was reduced. I don't know if that's true. He also made a mistake further on in the paper, and he talks about this experiment by Martin Tajmar and Clovis Dematis from like 2006, where they had a spinning superconductor, and they said that they had detected some enormous gravitomagnetic field, but that turned out to be an experimental error. You know, that was 12 years before this paper was published, so I'm surprised he didn't seem to know that, because when they took that experiment to like one of the LIGO facilities, I think maybe in Australia or something, they didn't detect any gravitomagnetic field there. And then they figured out, oh, it was just swirling gases inside the chamber that was creating the measurements that they were seeing. So although his theoretical arguments are really strong, and it does look like, you know, electric field, I guess the electric field energy has a negative sign, that experiment didn't prove it.
Yeah, I don't think the experiments are really good. I mean, just because you have been published in a peer-reviewed journal doesn't mean what you did is right.
Mm-hmm.
But it goes a long way to saying it wasn't obviously wrong. That's really important with experimental papers. I'm not sure with theoretical papers how they sort, but for experimental papers, if you can't get somebody to publish an interesting result, that's probably because anybody who looks at it sees, anybody that they'd have that would be competent to review the paper sees a major problem. And that's a little bit worrying when I see those sorts of things. Like, here's a presentation I saw 13 years ago, and the guy never published a paper on it. And probably something in the review process said, you know, this isn't right, and they weren't able to correct that particular problem and still get the same result.
Well, maybe that's how this got into his paper in past peer reviews, because those Tajmar Dematis were able to publish a couple of papers about this experimental result, because it wasn't readily evident that they had made an experimental error. They didn't discover that until later, you know.
He didn't reference any of Tajmar's papers. He referenced something from Softpedia.
Oh yeah, you're right. He could have referenced the papers though. I'm surprised the Softpedia reference made it in there.
Well, I'm not sure about this particular publication, to be honest. Also, I shouldn't say anything mean, but, you know, I tried to find this place called the Applied and Pure Research Institute, which very kindly has a address on it, which is 15, I shouldn't say.
Oh, in Amherst.
In Amherst, New Hampshire. Yeah, I shouldn't. I have to edit a bunch of that out. I mean, it's online. It'll be on the, it'll be there. He put, basically, that's his house, right? So one of these real estate places.
Did you look it up on Google Maps and you're like, that's a shack?
Well, it's a pretty nice shack. I mean, I looked at it. It has wonderful wood paneling. It's a really beautiful home. But I think it's his house.
So getting back to this.
I'm sorry. That was an aside.
Sorry. I just, my mind drifted for a minute because I was trying to think about like a way to experimentally test this, because one of the things that came up in the discussion about this repulsive gravitational field from electric charge was that in order to create like an acceleration of like negative 1g, then you would need to have an incredibly intense electric field gradient, like explosively intense. I think somebody was saying that the metal would shred itself to pieces before you could get this much charge on it. I'm not sure how that works, but apparently it's like three two or three orders of magnitude more intense electric field than anything we've been able to produce technologically yet. But then I was thinking about that, about how it doesn't matter what sign the electric field is. I wonder if it would be possible to have like an incredibly high frequency alternating electric field and prevent these kind of structural issues with holding that much charge on a really fine metal wire. Because that's what he was looking at. It's like you'd need an incredibly thin wire so that you could get the radius down really small, and then you'd have to put a huge charge on it. But then I remembered he was talking about a capacitor, right? So wasn't he saying that a capacitor should lose weight when you charge it?
Yeah, something like that. He was talking about another experiment where somebody was doing that.
Okay. So that's probably you'd have to look at that and see if that experiment was valid. Because I don't think I've heard of any experiment where they've actually detected a loss of mass in a charged capacitor. Have you?
No. He was talking about something strange there where somebody had rolled up the capacitor. Basically, you have parallel plates, maybe made out of foil, and then you roll them up, which is a normal way to make a capacitor. Somehow the person said that he got a lower weight after that.
So maybe he was doing some kind of torsion balance kind of experiment or something, right?
Possibly. So I'm not sure exactly where that is. There isn't a reference near the paper where Lowe seems to have analyzed that. Lowe has a paper called Weight Reduction of Charged Capacitors, Charge Mass Interaction, and Einstein's Unification, but there isn't an experimental paper on either side of that. Got Einstein and Weinberg above and Kaluza and Pauli below. So.
But the other thing that I noticed about this paper was that the scale of the claims. I mean, he's talking about like a unification, and I kind of expected him to get into that and explain, well, how does, you know, show me how that unification works. I mean, if it's so self-evident that you could model electromagnetism and gravitation in a five-dimensional theory, then show me how that works, right?
I mean, he's got a paper.
We covered it elsewhere.
Yeah, in the Hadronic Journal in 1989. So I don't know what the Hadronic Journal is, and I don't know what those 14 pages are, but it may be heavy going.
Yeah, multidimensional physics. I mean, four is hard enough. Seems like five would be even more difficult, right?
I'm not sure about that. So he was saying that he didn't want one of these Kaluza wrapped around dimensions. He wanted the fifth dimension to be completely flat or something like that. Or maybe not flat, but the infinite.
Right. But we covered those ideas, higher dimensional space times, in an earlier episode. And I thought it was determined that if you add an additional space dimension in the physical reality, then you end up with all kinds of serious problems and the laws of physics won't work.
That's usually the case. I think the only time we really talked about that in detail was with your Itzhak Barr's papers.
Yeah, the 2T physics, yeah.
The 2T physics. And Barr's was saying that if you add another time, everything goes haywire. And I think usually when you add another dimension, you end up with ghosts and all sorts of particles that just shouldn't exist. Or maybe you end up with all sorts of new physics that you should be able to detect, and you don't detect it, so you know it's wrong. But just like with Barr's, it could be that the way he's going about this, which is admittedly a little bit different than the way most people go about it, I think. I don't know. I don't know what the usual way to extend dimensions is. But, you know, Barr says if you go about it my way, assuming this particular symmetry.
Yeah. Well, I think he has six dimensions of space and two dimensions of time. And out of that, with a specific symmetry, you reproduce everything we observe.
Well, yeah, I think he had one extra dimension of space and one extra dimension of time. So it ended up being six dimensions total.
Oh, it was six total. Okay, yeah.
And so maybe something similar happens here because he's looking at this in light of a new particular interaction. So he's saying we need the five dimensions so we can have a new interaction between charge and mass.
But how is that true if, like David Waite had done, you could derive this gravitational repulsion using just the four-dimensional physics of general relativity?
I think for Lowe, he doesn't like that interpretation of what you see here. He's saying, as far as I can tell, that you get this metric, and it looks a little bit like you have a repulsive gravitational force based on the amount of charge on your black hole. But the way he says it is that the force you get does not match the metric you get. And so you need to look at things from a different direction in order to get the correct force, because you end up with a greater force than you'd get from the effective mass m minus q squared over 2r. And so to get that greater force, it has to come from a new force, not from the gravitational force.
Oh, I see. Okay, so that's where he's talking about a new charge-mass interaction in the context of a higher dimensional theory.
Yeah, and that would be another sort of repulsive force for the first order effect, and the second order effect would be a gravitational-like effect. So you'd get on top of the repulsive effect from his force, you'd end up with an attractive effect from moving charges.
Yeah, the charge currents, again, charge mass currents, I think he was looking at here. Yeah, but it's a shame because he mentions in his closing arguments the Pioneer anomaly, you know, could be explained this way. And we've learned that the Pioneer anomaly was just, you know, like radiation from the radioactive battery, right? It's a shame that there's so much interesting theoretical work here, but the experimental validations of them aren't valid.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that refers to a 2012 paper. His own. Gets me a little bit leery when I see a paper that references the main author 10 times. So
I'll validate my argument with other arguments that I've made.
If you are building up
a unified field theory, sure.
Yeah, I mean, you might not want to reproduce. Actually, technically, you're not supposed to reproduce all of this stuff every time you write about it. You want to have a pretty narrow focus for a paper.
Yeah, so now that I'm looking at his references, I'm like, oh, okay, so he's been talking about this for a long time, so there may be a lot of answers about these questions that I've got that are already published in his earlier work.
Yeah. I don't know about the fifth force. It doesn't really seem to be something we need to look at for the evidence we have.
But you can still get that 1 over r cubed term just right out of general relativity, right? That's what David Waite was looking at.
Well, yeah. No, Lowe is saying that that's not enough. But you do get that repulsive force from general relativity by shoving the electromagnetic stress energy tensor into the gravitational stress energy tensor.
Well, I like it. It's really fascinating stuff.
So yeah, that's more or less what happens there. Now, did you like these papers I found by looking at Mr. Thorne and Wheeler, Big Black Book of Gravitation?
I somehow missed that.
Well, no, like the Carter paper and the Graves and Brill paper. Oscillatory character of Reissner-Nordström metric for an ideal charged wormhole. And I think probably the gravitational bounce one as well. Those I all found from that giant gravitation textbook. So basically the Reissner-Nordström metric is a problem in that book. They say, okay, go ahead and do this. And if you want the answers, these are the papers that give you the answers. So these are the papers that give you the answers to problem 31.7.
Well, which one? What problem was that? Were they talking about this kind of scenario?
That was the charged black hole problem.
Okay.
And then they have all the Penrose diagrams in, like, chapter 34.
Well, I'd love to cover the Penrose diagrams because they're fascinating stuff. I mean, it seems like science fiction, you know, but it falls right out of general relativity. And, you know, to see that you can have, you know, really precise analytical, you know, arguments for these, the topology of different spacetimes within the event horizon of a black hole is just wonderful stuff. So yeah, we'll have to do that. And another thing that's coming up that I like to talk about maybe in our next show is this Anita anomaly from the Antarctic, like, ice cube experiments and everything, where they're doing, even detecting another weird neutrino anomaly. So maybe we can do that next time and then circle back to the Penrose diagrams and have some fun with the black holes.
Okay, we can look at that. Is that the one where they're saying that everything's going backwards in time?
Yeah, there's one impossible explanation, which strikes me as probably the most unlikely explanation, was that somebody had hypothesized that there were the neutrinos traveling back in time. I guess that somehow arrived from a parallel dimension where time runs backwards, and that this anomaly could be explained if that was happening.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That just showed up in my feed this morning.
But then I looked into it a little bit, and there's actually a huge range of much more plausible types of explanations.
I'm not surprised.
But, you know, the pop press just, a parallel universe where time runs backwards, that's going to make the headline. And I couldn't find a paper about it. Like, they talk about somebody writing, I think, one of the, like, the leads on that Anita project where they've, I guess they're doing detections in the atmosphere. Apparently the lead had talked about publishing a paper about this, but I can't find it anywhere. So I don't know if it didn't pass peer review or what's going on with that, but I want to look more into that. It's another fun neutrino anomaly thing. It's definitely like there's several papers talking about how the standard model can't explain what they're seeing. So that's exciting.
That's good. We want more anomalies.
That's right. Give me the anomalies.
Yeah, I need to put that up on the wiki page. But I'm not going to tell anybody where the wiki page is.
Why? Don't you want everybody on the planet editing your work?
I don't have to give them permission to do it. But based on what happened when we tried to put the message board together,
yeah.
I mean, I still get spam on the blog because of that. I took down the message board.
Somehow the link got saved by the bots, and now they're still attacking you at your home base.
Yeah, so whatever I put on as the homepage for www.physicsfm.com, all the bots go there. You know, you get 50,000 hits a day or something like that.
Jesus Christ.
Then I just have to delete all the comments, you know, telling me where to find cheap Ukrainian Viagra.
I guess somebody must be actually clicking on these links for these spam bots to be so prolific. I mean, somebody's paying for that, right? Or do they just take on a life of their own just for the rest of eternity? We're going to have billions of bots trying to sell us Viagra. The only thing that lasts forever on the internet is the bots.
Well, yeah. I mean, it just takes, you know, one idiot to click on the link and buy some stuff from them. And the rest of us get screwed over because somebody actually looks at this sort of word salad and thinks it's a great idea to try to get some cheap drugs from somebody who you have no idea who they are. That's always a good idea.
Total strangers halfway around the world. Yeah. So I was thinking about this charge capacitor thing that he was talking about in this paper. It occurs to me that although you have a problem with like dielectric breakdown when you try to get your charge super high with a capacitor, isn't it possible to defeat that problem by alternating the charge on each plate extremely rapidly so that there isn't enough time for an electric field to propagate to the other side?
I mean, the metal's going to have its own characteristics or resonances, so you've got a limit to how fast you can swap them. The AC current is going to heat things up.
So you can't do it superconducting.
Yeah, so it will probably burn out if you're trying to put huge amounts of charge on something going back and forth.
Try to solve one problem and you create more. Well, I'd say I'd just love to see some kind of experimental work done to measure this repulsive gravitational field of electric charge. I mean, this is such a cool idea. There's got to be some way to bring that within reach, right?
There may be. I have no idea. I mean, if this would be real, then eventually it will show up. Eventually they'll figure out ways to get to higher field. Now, if you said it was only two orders of magnitude larger than what we have now, then that's something that might happen in a decade or two, depending on what the researchers think they're going to find or what they can do with it. I mean, if somebody thought they could get a real technological application out of it, it would probably take 5 years. But you know, if somebody's going to make $1 billion off of it, it'll show up, right? But if they just think it's interesting, it's still 20 years, something will happen. So, I mean, that's why we have, like, the National High Magnetic Field Labs, right? Yeah, all they do is figure out ways to make higher magnetic fields, right? That's their job. Yeah. I expect that somebody will figure out ways to make higher electric.
Yeah, all right, cool. I think I'd love to see that. You know, the first experimental detection of repulsive gravitation in our lifetimes, that would be really exciting.
It would. Oh, no, I think when he was talking about this, he said something that will make you sad.
Oh, no, what?
I think when Lowe was talking about this, he said that because of the current thing, or you won't get any levitating cars.
And why was that?
Basically because you'll never get as much charge as you need to do this. It'll be sad. I think he also talked about that in terms of that current. So if you start moving that, it gets even worse. You'd want something like that where if you started moving, it would help you with the lift. But in this case, it makes it more attractive. Then you'd have more problems as well. But I think the magnitude was too small to actually do that.
Yeah, because, you know, it's like energy and mass, right? I mean, the constant conversion is, you know, is C squared. So if you're trying to get electrical energy, right, then you're going to need like a ridiculously intense electrical energy in order to make that term significant. And the rest mass of every physical object is so high that trying to make a term higher than the rest mass is pretty unthinkable, right? But still, maybe there's other ways of finding something useful about it. You know, I'm delighted every time I see an advancement in theoretical physics where there's like a new idea, like we saw with Jack Wisdom's swimming in space-time idea, a new concept in gravitational field propulsion. But, you know, maybe there's going to be some clever person out there that figures out a way to make something useful out of this. And then if they can pitch it to Bill Gates, maybe we'll get an experiment made, you know?
Maybe. We'll find out.
Yeah, we'll find out, I hope. All right, Jim. Thanks for going over all this with me. We touched on a lot of fascinating stuff, and I think there's a lot of material here with the Penrose diagrams and everything to have some fun with later.
All right. We'll figure out what we want to do with Penrose diagrams right after this. Okay. Well, bye now, Randy.
Bye, folks.
You have just listened to episode number 53 of Physics Frontiers, the electromagnetic gravitational repulsion. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/53. Show notes include the papers we read for this podcast, as well as links to related episodes of Physics Frontiers and books that we may have mentioned. Included in books that we mentioned is The Nature of Space and Time by Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose. I'll put an Amazon link for that. It's nice and cheap, and I'm sure you'd love it. It's a Princeton Science Library book. I liked it very much. And finally, I did ask my Patreon supporters if they minded if I read their names at the end of the podcast, or if they wanted to, and since nobody said no and somebody said yes, I will. If you are a Patreon supporter and you actually didn't want this to happen and you just didn't look at the Patreon page in the past month or so since the poll's been up, talk to me and I'll stop doing it. Now, I should have looked at some of these names before I did this because it turns out I don't know how to pronounce anybody's name. So I'm sorry in advance if I screw some of these names up. I'm trying my best. Let's start with Viking Kylidian. I'm sorry, I do not know where that name came from. I don't know how to pronounce the J. Probably don't know how to pronounce the I either. Lucas Enner Walcher. Dan Maxim. Mark G. Ron McKinnon. Jordan Lynn. Tyler Durden. Ian Helen. Chris Sherman. Stephen Komen. SD. I only have initials. Bill Warner. Tim Stefani. Alexander Milton Kavanaemi, Linda Kilmer, Paul Moritz, and Wasim Zahir. Thank you all very, very much for supporting us. I'll talk to you next time. Bye now.